Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinny Eastwood Show. The show that shoots laser beams out of its eyes when it sees David Rockefeller. The show that's bulletproof. The show that's so bright it'll scald your cuticles when you go into a hair salon. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you will most certainly go friggin' nuts. Very special guest today is a famous and fabulous and various other words beginning with the letter F man, Mike Billington from La Roche Pack. Welcome, mate.
Hi, good to be here again.
Can you tell us what's new, mate?
What's new? Well, what's new is that the world is sitting on the very brink of thermonuclear war. It's increasingly evident to the entire world that the attempt to start a war in Syria and Iran has little to do with Syria and Iran, but everything to do with the effort of the British and the Wall Street financial interests to break the idea of sovereignty in general, and in particular to force Russia to back down and China to back down, but especially Russia to back down from the new imperial policy, which goes under the name of regime change, which is being implemented by the British and by George W. Bush and Barack Obama, who have completely capitulated to the British ideology, to the imperial concept, and at the same time, and very much related, we are in the midst of the greatest financial breakdown crisis in the history of civilization. And in fact, Mr. LaRouche, in an address this last week to a diplomatic luncheon with very significant representatives from the embassies from around the world in Washington, made the point that what's driving this push for war is precisely that economic collapse, a collapse which is now panic. Financial interests across Europe and the United States. The only other very, very important thing to say as we start is that that financial panic has caused one of the most dramatic shifts in modern history, at least, where a group of leading British financial oligarchs, leading with the Financial Times itself, the voice of the City of London, and then followed by a leading member of the Hambro family, of the Imperial Hambro investment banking family, and others, to do a 180-degree shift and call for Glass-Steagall, call for the separation of investment banking and commercial banking, to end government guarantees to these wild speculative binges that have been permitted both in the UK and the United States since the big bang of Maggie Thatcher and the destruction of Glass-Steagall, which was the Roosevelt policy of separating investment banks and guaranteeing only commercial banks, only real investments in real industry, agriculture, schools, hospitals, real things, not derivatives and gambling debts and speculation. With the takedown of Glass-Steagall, we saw the creation of the greatest financial bubble in history. And some of the same people who caused that, who caused the takedown of Glass-Steagall, who created the bubble, are now saying, oh my God, we're all going under, and we better go back to Glass-Steagall. We better follow LaRouche's advice and return to the FDR Glass-Steagall policy. I think the most famous case of this was Sandy Weill, the former head of Citibank, who was known as the shatterer of Glass-Steagall, who himself famously 2 weeks ago said, we're finished. The whole banking system is finished, not just the commercial banks, but all of us in the investment banking house, we're all finished, and we're probably heading for war. He didn't add that, but I think he knows it. We're probably heading for war if we don't reverse the collapse of this banking system. The way Sandy Weill said it was, if America is going to be a leader in the world, we better have a banking system, and if we don't stop this soon, we won't. So
now,
this is...
Originally, the Glass-Steagall was put in because of the original depression, which was caused by all these gambling, speculative, derivative type things, wasn't it?
Same people, J.P. Morgan and his family, yeah, the Morgan interests and their other British banking interests who had increasingly taken over the American banking system, largely under J.P. Morgan's direction. And so when Roosevelt came in, and here again you see the connection between the strategic issue and the banking issue, Roosevelt recognized that Europe had been put under the jackboot of fascism with Mussolini, Hitler, Franco, and so forth by the British banking interests, by Montague Norman, the head of the Bank of England, and other financial interests who had funded the rise to power of those fascist governments and were fully committed to bringing that fascist form of government into the United States. They were on the way under Hoover, the president before Roosevelt. And when Roosevelt came into power, he knew that the only way to stop fascism internationally and in the United States was to basically take on the banks, which he did. He shut them down day one of his presidency. The banks went on a 10-day banking holiday, and they only opened up when they could show they'd wiped off the speculative garbage. They didn't bail out the speculative garbage. They wrote it off. Then the government issued credit into the banking system with strings attached. So it only went into real investments. And one of the first things he did after that bank holiday was mobilize the country behind what was called the PCORA Commission, where basically the Senate held hearings into what caused the depression. And all the bankers were brought before the Senate, and the entire American population was listening in on the radio, and their crimes were exposed. Sort of the way some of the crimes are being exposed right now of Timothy Geithner, who knew about the LIBOR scandal, who knew about the HSBC Hongxiang drug money laundering, and did nothing. So these crimes...
I heard a rumor about little Timmy Geithner is that recently he allegedly got arrested and started squealing like a little girl. Oh, they forced us to do it. Did you hear about that?
Got arrested.
Yeah, no. And
he
New York
be. He should be arrested. No, he should be arrested.
Saying like a jailbird, catch and release like a trout.
No, I wish that were true, but I don't think it is. What did happen, though, was that the day Sandy Weill made his Damascus Road transformation and came out demanding that we return to Glass-Steagall, Geithner was appearing before the House the next day before the Senate. I guess it was two different House committees. But in any case, in those hearings, suddenly the Congress found a little bit of courage, these gutless wonders in our Congress, because Sandy Weill had come out and admitted that we were on the brink of destruction. So they went after him. They went after him for the fact that he knew about the LIBOR scandal when it was happening and did not forward it to the Justice Department for criminal prosecution, which was his legal responsibility, i.e. he's a criminal for not doing so, and that he also knew about the drug running at the Hongshang, which was exposed recently by the U.S. Senate. Of course, it was exposed by our organization, I think you know, by our book Dope Incorporated in 1978. So anybody following us knew that the HSBC was the central bank of the British drug running operation historically and still today. But it was finally exposed by the Senate. Geithner had to admit that they knew all about it. And he and his cohorts, his City of London, Wall Street loving friends, basically are trying to prevent a criminal prosecution for these crimes by striking another sweetheart deal with the HSBC. You know, give them a little slap on the wrist, a few million-dollar fine, and off they go. Nobody goes to jail. Well, this is being brought into question. We're on a point where if we do things right over these coming weeks, we could reverse this rapid decline into global financial breakdown and thermonuclear war. It would require that the Glass-Steagall bill be rammed through this Congress, and there's now increasing recognition in the Congress that that's the only hope we have of stopping the collapse of civilization. And I don't mean that as a hyperbole. That literally means the threat of a collapse of civilization. And they know that it won't happen with Obama in the White House. Nor, if we wait around for the November election, would it happen with Wall Street's Mitt Romney in the White House. So the only hope we have is that this country wakes up over this next month, before the September 3rd Democratic Convention begins. They recognize that this fanatic in the White House, this narcissistic idiot, this who prides himself on killing people around the world, prides himself on the savior of Wall Street while he destroys the physical economy of our nation and the world, that this guy cannot be president.
Has Barack Obama so far said anything that turned out to be true? Like, can you think of it? Does anything come to mind? I remember he said that there are children in America once, and I think that that's true.
It could be. I mean, this electoral campaign is a ugly, it's a joke, you know, and I know you like to make fun of genocide, but it's only funny in that sense. I mean, this is a campaign where you have two people claiming to be such a different, you know, totally different policies, and yet they're exactly the same policies. They're both committed to the bailout of Wall Street at any cost. Trillions of dollars driving the world into hyperinflationary bust. They're both committed to warfare everywhere, to the destruction of Syria, the destruction of Libya, the destruction of Russia, the destruction of China, if need be, they say. And there's no difference. So the only hope is that this person be forced to resign the way Lyndon Johnson was before his reelection campaign over the Vietnam War, the way Nixon was, unfortunately, after his reelection, forced to resign by his own party, so that a real Democrat can be put forward as a candidate for the presidency, in which case he'd probably...
I've not seen any Democrats that I'd really like apart from maybe Dennis Kucinich.
No, not a chance. He's not a presidential candidate.
Yeah.
And he's not a presidential timber. But there are many people in the Congress. They're not going to be charismatic hero type people, but there are many people in the Congress who are competent and who, in the process of getting Obama out of office, would, in a certain sense, be turning power over to more of the institutions in the United States, including, for instance, our military leadership, our intelligence community leadership, former presidents, former congressmen. the institutional structure, which would include Lyndon LaRouche very much as part of that institutional structure of America. In that case, that president could serve under an impulse that said we must end the bailout, end this warmongering policy, and begin to implement the kind of American system principles, both the Glass-Steagall, and we should discuss later on more than that. Glass-Steagall on its own won't do the job, because if you do implement Glass-Steagall right now, the commercial banking system, which has been so completely looted by the takeover of the bank holding companies, the speculators, won't have any credit. When we take the junk out of the system and hand it back to Goldman Sachs and Merrill Lynch and make them investment banks again and let them collapse, which they probably will, the commercial banks are going to be starved of credit. We must re-implement the American system idea of creditary economics, which Alexander Hamilton and his associates implemented with the National Bank of the United States, where we're not reduced as a nation to borrow from private banks, which is what our Federal Reserve is, but issue credit in the name of the government with directed towards those things needed for the general welfare of the population. The basic infrastructure, the industry, agriculture, soft infrastructure like schools and hospitals. And if we implement that creditary policy here and around the world, so that we can again begin to direct credit into things needed rather than allowing private bankers to maximize their profit as the guide to where the credit goes, which always devolves into speculation and gambling debts.
What I always found really strange about how the American system kind of spends money on its infrastructure and things of that nature is that it's got an aging old idea infrastructure. Like, for example, just take trains. How fast does the average United States train go? It's like, what, 80 miles an hour, something like that? And then
you've
got bullet trains in France and stuff that get, 400 miles an hour?
I might not have the exact title right, but I think the deputy director of the IMF is a Chinese guy, Justin Lin, I think. And he came down to Washington from his office in New York at one point and gave a speech here. This was about a year and a half ago. But we had just had a big thunderstorm here in Washington. I live outside of Washington. And he said, you got to go? I'll be back.
Well, we've got about maybe 15 seconds to wrap up, if you want.
Oh, okay. Well, he said two things. He said, well, I just came down on the fastest train from New York to Washington. It took about three times longer than it would have taken the same trip in China. And I got here and there was a thunderstorm and all the lights went out. It reminded me of 1950s China.
Oh my God. Hey, and we'll be reminded of communist China soon enough. We'll be right back.
Bonkers.
I wake up every day as a daydream. Everything in my life ain't what it seems. I wake up just to go back to sleep. I act real shallow, but I'm in too deep. And all I care about is sex and violence. And every baseline is my kind of silence. Everybody says that I gotta get a grip, but unless sanity give me the slip.
Bonkers.
Some people think I'm bonkers, but I just think I'm free. And I'm just living my life, there's nothing crazy about me. Some people pay for thrills, but I get mine for free. Man, I'm just living my life, there's nothing crazy about me.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It is a little bit of a bonkers show, but hey, it's no more bonkers than the rest of the world. No more bonkers than political policy. No more bonkers than going into the DMV and having the wrong form and having to stand in line all over again and getting the runaround and trying to get your Medicaid card and trying to get off heroin real badly because the CIA guy sold it to you and he gave you some bad crap and you figure, man, you all got to get off the stuff. Hopefully there's some kind of Medicaid plan, Mark, but unfortunately you got in too late and you're going to have to get the runaround all day long. I've got to love that health system. And Obamacare is going to be even better, ladies and gentlemen. It's going to be fantastic. Absolutely. It's going to solve all those problems of all those old sick people because there's even like that I read? A doctor's euthanasia policy, basically. If you are old enough, sick enough, the doctor can decide whether or not treating you is worth it.
Well, not the doctor. No, a private team to be set up called the IPAB, the Independent Price Advisory Board, which will be appointed by the president and will be experts, not even doctors, maybe some doctors.
Whoa. Experts on the price of human life.
Exactly right. This is why we put that Nazi Hitler mustache on Obama, because this health bill duplicates what Hitler did as his first act of genocide, and for which he was condemned at the Nuremberg trial by Justice Jackson, when he said that the first step where you determine that certain lives are not worth living, you have gone over the edge onto the slippery slope. That's where the crime against humanity took place. And that crime has already taken place under the Obamacare bill here by the setting up of IPAB, who will determine on price benefit analysis, right, which people should live and which people should die, who no longer can serve a useful purpose to society and therefore should not be using up valuable resources of our society, keeping them alive. This is what has already been passed as law. There's bills in the Congress to overturn that part. We'll see. But this is a Nazi policy from the Tiergarten Fear policy that Hitler set in motion as the first step towards his genocide program. That's what we have in the United States.
There's a German word that means unworthy life. It's called Untermenschen.
Untermenschen.
And that was what everybody was defined as, if you're Jewish, black, gay, mentally retarded, anything of that nature. You were Untermenschen. Sorry, we're going to have to kill you.
Long before the genocide against the Jews and the Gypsies and the whatever else was the policy that said that we're at war, therefore we can't waste money on people who are going to die anyway. And, of course, that's a very subjective decision. One of the people who helped write the Obamacare bill, the brother of Rahm Emanuel, Ezekiel. I mean, Rahm Emanuel was one of the top advisors to Obama. His brother, Ezekiel Emanuel, is a guy who's for his whole life has been involved in how to implement genocide through the medical system. And he wrote a document that I pulled out and published that got circulated around the world that said it should be obvious. This is almost a quote. It should be obvious that certain cases like mental dementia should not be using up resources in a time of scarce resources. And that we should have to just make the hard decision that says certain lives should just have to be let go. And that's the genocide policy which we're staring right in the face here in the United States. And, of course, it's already very active in England, where they have the policy of putting people on heavy drugs and denying them food and medicine, often without their approval, in a policy which can only be described as genocide.
Well, I think that is part of human history that people think disappeared long ago. It's still very, 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 very active today. Yeah, in fact, absolutely. I think genocide is actually almost more active globally today in terms of how many people it currently affects than at any other point through history. We're being affected from genocide at all sides. You know, our food's killing us. Our water's killing us. Our air's killing us.
Or the
our
lack
government's
of food,
killing us.
The lack of food and the lack of water, rather than our food and our water. It's the fact
they get you,
that
they get you one way or the other.
Yeah. No. What you have
kills you, and to not have it would mean you would die.
What they call natural phenomena are not natural phenomena. We're now experiencing in the United States. I don't know if this is being covered in your part of the world, but we're now experiencing the worst drought in possibly the history of the United States. Over one half of the counties of this nation are now in a state of emergency because of the drought and because of the wildfires, which are, it's not quite the worst case yet of wildfires, but it's almost as bad as it's ever been, spreading through the country, especially mostly that Midwest to West part of the country, the mountain area and the Midwest part of the country. Now, I think we discussed last time I was on here that back in the 1950s and 60s, the Parsons Company developed a plan which President Kennedy, was absolutely committed to, called the North America Water and Power Alliance, NAWPA, which could have been implemented long ago had Kennedy not been killed. and had we not gone into the Vietnam War instead of into development. But that would bring water down from Alaska and the Yukon that now drains off into the Arctic Ocean and elsewhere, and bring it down into the U.S., into the northern Mexico, which could and will, if we do this, transform that desert, what's called the Great American Desert, into one of the greatest green agricultural areas in the world. That we could double the agricultural land in the United States. We could be feeding parts of the world that are facing starvation now. And because we did not do that, we're now facing drought, we're facing, and in fact, let me add, were we to do that program, it not only would provide water, but it would actually change the climate. Because when you introduce water into a region that's dry, you begin to get the process of the water being lifted up into the sky and falling again. You get about 2.5 drops of water for every drop you introduce through the recycling process of nature. So we change the climate. We would not be facing this devastating collapse now, which has destroyed most of our food, a good portion of our food crop. Most of our corn crop is being just decimated to the point where a large number of our congressmen who represent agriculture areas have correctly demanded that the entire ethanol program be dropped because our food, our corn especially, is being burned up in this crazy ethanol policy when in fact we definitely...
And then the bankers come in and they gamble on all the rising food prices because absolutely. After food's being turned into petrol. Yeah.
They're making a fortune right now on the spiking of the corn price, which is killing our animal producers, our pig and chicken and beef producers who depend on cheap feed from corn primarily, are being killed. So we're not only looking at no corn in the market, we're looking at no meat in the market. I mean, this is a very, very serious food crisis.
And with the Gulf of Mexico incident taking out a huge portion of the Gulf seafood chain, and with the Fukushima crisis irradiating copious quantities of Pacific life, what's going to be left for people to eat?
Yeah, actually, that's not true about the Fukushima thing. That's something that was put out by people who were basically anti-nuclear, but it's just not the case. The release.
So there's no radioactive contamination in the Pacific Ocean from Fukushima?
No, it's just not true. Very, very tiny amounts were let out and very quickly disseminated and dispersed. Now, there's no serious... There's some land which you're going to have to not use for a while it sort of revives itself. But the leaks from Fukushima were serious in the sense of nuclear accidents, but nowhere near as devastating as were produced, as finally, thankfully, the Japanese people have come to recognize and are starting to reopen their nuclear plants. They almost went the way of Germany in shutting down their nuclear facilities, which would have been just one of the biggest blows to humanity in history. It would have basically destroyed not only Japan, but much of the world, which was following that, right? But the Japanese, despite the fact that they know what real nuclear holocaust is from having been bombed, you know, for no reason, for absolutely no reason, twice, they know.
I'd say experimentation is a reason.
Yeah, no good reason. I agree with you. Yes, experimentation. No, they'd actually experimented with the bombs, but its intention was to scare the hell out of the Russians and to basically say to developing countries and other countries in the world, we're crazy enough to use these insane weapons. Therefore, you better do what we say. Give up your sovereignty. Allow world government, right? Allow global financial government over your economies. What we're facing today, people have to really reflect on this. What's happened in Europe is that already we have several countries which have lost their sovereignty, absolutely lost it. Greece is no longer a sovereign nation. It can make no decisions that does not have the approval of the Troika, which is the IMF, the European Central Bank, ECB, and the EU, the European Commission. Without the permission of the Troika, they can do nothing. Spain then had to beg for a bailout. And Rajoy, their prime minister, said, we'll never accept the conditions Greece did. We accepted this bailout, but no conditions. And then the conditions were printed, and they're precisely the same. They can do nothing without the approval of the Troika. Italy is now facing the same thing. We're looking at the decimation of the sovereignty of the European nations in an even more devastating form than the sovereignty of most developing sector nations was taken over by the IMF over these last 30 or 40 years. So this is a very threat to the idea of nationhood.
What's it called when 100 different problems that seem isolated suddenly come together all at once?
No, it's absolutely true. It's waking people up to the reality that this is a threat to civilization in general. Now, if you now add to that, that the solar system is moving through our galaxy into an area which happens only about every 60 million years, but we're moving rapidly into there's sort of a sine wave movement of the galaxy through the spiral arms of the solar system, through the spiral arms of the galaxy. And we're now moving north of the spiral arms in an area where we're going to have far more cosmic radiation crises, not just from the sun, but from other parts of the universe. And that we will be facing the threat of far, far more threatening asteroids, more electronic effects from pulsar stars, from the Crab Nebula cosmic radiation phenomena that affect our Earth. And if we don't prepare now for something that could happen in the next 50 years or the next 50,000 years, we don't know. But we're human beings. We have to be thinking about what happens to our world, our species, our commitment as human beings to the idea that we, unlike animals, have the creative powers of mind. We don't have to become extinct like the dinosaurs if we use those minds to develop our capacities to go to Mars, to go to outer space. The development with this landing of this thing on Mars is a tremendous victory for mankind, because it only happened because of very serious fights by people within NASA and within our military, who said to Obama, you cannot continue cutting everything. I mean, he's virtually tried to shut down NASA. He's shut down our manned space program completely. Devastating blow to civilization to have done that. But at least they fought through and continued with this small step, actually, but very dramatic, to begin to show that we could be colonizing the moon, we could be colonizing Mars, and we damn well better, so that we're capable of dealing with incoming asteroids, with things that are going to happen. We have to begin to think in terms of what we as a species are going to do to it to guarantee our future existence. So we've got threats from the collapse of the economy, of the war, and now outer space. Go ahead. Sorry, I took you over. Oh, you're not hearing me. Huh. You're not hearing me, huh? I'm speaking. Can you hear me at all? I can't hear you.
Okay, there we go. Sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. Okay. It's a problem with sometimes you Bluetooth mouse decides to reconnect every now and again, right in the middle when I need to press the unmute button.
Okay. I hit the mute and unmute and it popped back in. Sorry.
Yeah. I heard you the entire time. It was just I couldn't speak.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, this whole thing about the coming round, you mentioned the number 60 million. Well, I was in a conference with David Wilcock, and he actually put up this graph of paleontology and all the stuff that's been unearthed over the years. And apparently every 60 million years, there is a huge, huge spike in the emergence of new species. They just suddenly come out of nowhere. So let's wonder about that and ponder. Think about that, ladies and gentlemen. Imagine if we're on the verge of a point in time that happens regularly throughout the universe, where a whole bunch of new creatures that never existed ever before suddenly all appear at the same time. It'd be an interesting time to live through, don't you think? We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
We're gonna make love. You know how I know?
Because it's Wall Street.
It's Wednesday. And Wednesday night.
And Wall Street's the place where we usually make love. Make love to very expensive prostitutes.
There's nothing good on TV.
While huffing copious quantities of very, very freshly imported cocaine. So laundering the money through our Wall Street listed stock market companies like Coca-Cola and Pepsi.
You say something to me like, I might go to bed.
I might go down to the supermarket and get myself some freshly mounted, you know, Canadian boys, and maybe sacrifice them to my deadly sexual predator, pedophile.
It's business time.
That's what you mean. You mean it's business time.
It's business time, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the sexiest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, on AMFM affiliates all across America and around the world in the Fourth Reich sense of the word. Mike Billington is my very special guest. And we were talking over the break about, you said you had a basement team, is that correct, who deal in the very, well, basically the real freaky topics that would make people go, Or have a big burst of cognitive dissonance and just start calling your names like conspiracy theorist or cook.
Well, no, the basement team is called the basement team because it works in our basement, in the basement of the sort of central house we have. No, this is a 33. If you haven't been to our website, Vinny, you should go. The website is www.LaRouchePAC, P-A-C, for Political Action Committee, LaRouchePAC. com. And you'll see there that we have videos on exactly the things we've been discussing, these galactic issues, as well as history, as well as science, as well as the political updates, videos that are produced every day, 3 news videos every day, 2 to 3, and long historical and economic studies and so forth, done mostly by what we call the basement team, which is just a team of young people who began to work on these fundamental science issues. They read through Gauss, they read through Riemann, they read through Einstein. They worked on developing not only what these people taught, but how they made their discoveries, how they thought. And people like Kepler writes about how he thought, which is very crucial. And instead of the kind of regurgitation you get in our colleges today where you just taught the formula that resulted from somebody's study, you actually have to figure out how those discoveries came about if you're going to develop in your own mind the creative capacities to make those new discoveries. So this was the approach that was taken under LaRouche's direction. And your listeners, I strongly encourage you, go to LaRouchePAC.com and you'll be amazed. And go back through the archives, get a sense of the kind of work we've done. If we're going to survive, we're going to have a renaissance. We're going to have a cultural, political, economic renaissance. We're going to have to end the age of popular opinion, have to end the Pepsi generation of what makes you feel good. We're going to have to end the era of human beings are only animals who respond to sense perception, who only feel good or feel bad. This was the way the British Empire controlled the masses, through pleasure and pain, feeling good or feeling bad. Their interpretation of economics was that it was just what makes you feel good or what makes you feel bad. That's not what the human being is. We have creative powers of the mind. We're able to think in terms of what the future will be by what we do today. Animals can't do that, and you're not just responding to what makes you feel good for the minute. So this is a concept which we have to fight to revive if we're going to win. The populations of our nation here in the United States, and I'm certain it's true in New Zealand and Australia, have been dumbed down so horribly since the 1960s with drugs and countercultural demise and so forth. And the destruction of our education, that you don't have people with a sense that they have a future. And therefore, when you have the economic collapse brought down on top of that, people become, you know, they become they become animalistic. They lose their sense that we can do something about the world. Well, we have to revive that sense in everybody. And that requires that we revive a fight for great music, great culture, that we understand history, that we learn science. Everybody, not just the scientists, everybody has to know basic science. And that's the commitment of LaRouche's movement. That's what you'll see at LaRouchePack.com. So it's something we have to take seriously. We're not going to get through this just by exposing the bad guys. We're going to have to build a truly revolutionary movement of people on the Renaissance ideas that gave us the Renaissance, that gave us the American Revolution, which is that the human being is defined by his creative potential, and that we have to evoke that inside people. And what you were saying before about what would make you be willing to die. Well, you know, the great German Renaissance figure, Friedrich Schiller, we call ourselves the Schiller Institute, by the way, named after Friedrich Schiller, the poet.
But it doesn't imply that you're all shills there, of course.
Not shills, Schiller.
Okay.
The author of the one thing most people know of Schiller is the Ode to Joy of Beethoven, the Ninth Symphony, which was based on Schiller's On die Freude. But Schiller wrote about the sublime, and this concept of the sublime, which is not known today, it's basically referencing the fact that you have to be able to find in yourself something that's more important than life itself. If you're going to live with the idea that you're going to realize your total humanity, it has to be based on something more than just a day-to-day living, but rather the fact that your immortality is based upon your commitment of the development of your mind and the application of that creative power to creating a better future for mankind.
I had an idea, and I want to run it by you. You know how we think differently to the majority of brainwashed society, and that public schooling is not the kind of place for us to be educated. And there's a whole bunch of people out there who are really creative. They have entrepreneurship. They've got talents and what have you. And the current system basically just destroys all those, you know, from kindergarten and elementary school through to high school and university. It's just designed not to, as that other scientist who you mentioned earlier, tell you how you think, you know, how to think or anything like that, just telling you what to think. What if we instead revamp that, and from the early childhood education right the way through to university, we create a parallel model that takes the existing model, which does not work, and instead teaches them the real history, the real science, the real social skills, and the real way to interact with people, and real ways to create businesses, become entrepreneurs, and things of that nature. Would this parallel system have a way of, in some way, capturing a generation so that the next generation that they become the leaders of would perhaps produce a society closer to what we would want to see?
No, I don't think so. No, you have this. It's a question of government. I mean, your concept is right. We have to do that. But the question is, how do you teach the teachers who can teach that? We don't have the teachers who can teach that today. And you have to
What if you were a guest lecturer, Michael, and I was a guest lecturer, and G. Edward Griffin, who wrote the and so on and so forth, people in the truth community, as we say now, in the activism community, I feel quite strongly that in fact they are now the teachers of our society.
Yeah. Well, yes, but I mean, to a certain extent, I would agree, although I don't always agree that the people who think they're part of that are doing some great benefit. But if we're going to change this, we're going to have to change it as sovereign nations. So this is the importance of culture and the importance of sovereignty. It's not just that the nation has a right to exist against other nations who are imperial, but nations are defined by a certain language, culture. They're defined by a certain educational capacity historically and so on. And if we're going to do this, it's going to only happen not through creating a parallel educational policy to public education, but by mobilizing the population for a political transformation, a revolutionary transformation in the broader sense, with culture included, in which context we then are going to have the capacity to deal with this destroyed public education system, as well as our colleges. But it's going to have to happen by that commitment to changing the entire system. The system is dead. Our economic system is dead. Monetarism will never be revived. you can't save the monetarist system. The attempt to save the monetarist system today means printing so much money that you're going to have hyperinflation like you had in Germany in 1923, and meaning that money becomes worthless. So people have to start from the premise that money is meaningless. Money has no value. Money is only a useful tool in a creditary system where the value is based on how you increase the productivity of your nation and your population. That's what measures value, not how many things you may have or what somebody thinks money is worth. Because the hyperinflation proves that money can be turned into toilet paper overnight. If you keep printing money the way it is today, it'll be like in Germany, where all of a sudden a million marks couldn't buy you a loaf of bread. And we're going to be close to that real soon. If we don't deal with the physical economy that's being destroyed while the money is being printed at catastrophic rates. So,
well, see, Michael, that makes a lot more sense than get a haircut and get a real job in terms of economic policy that is taught to children.
yeah, exactly. Because that's all they're educated for, is to get jobs in a future that's not going to exist.
Well, you know? I think that in my opinion, the future never exists, because by the time you reach it, technically it ain't in the future anymore. It's still a gift. It's called the present. Well, thank you, Michael, for coming on the show today. And ladies and gentlemen, LaRouchePack.com is the place where you can go. Michael, final words. Got about 30 seconds.
What's that?
Got about 30 seconds if you want to say anything more.
Oh, just thanks for being here. I think everybody senses we're at a turning point in history. And the question is, will the leadership that LaRouche has provided over these years, which is now coming to the fore and people are getting a hold of it, will people have the courage to actually stand up with us here and in your country and in Australia, where we have an organization to put this through now?
We'll be back next hour with Chris.
Good to see you. Thanks a lot.
Ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness and scumbaggery, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. I was talking to my mate in the car yesterday, and he was talking about some new thing, some microchip or some kind of laser beam from space or something that's going to kill me. And I said to him, dude, in my line of work, I get told that there's something new that's about to kill me on a daily basis. And do you know what every single one of those things has in common? I was still alive when I heard about them. My very special guest today from thegreatculling.org is Chris Maple. Chris, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Vinny. Thanks for having me, man. It's good to be here.
It's cool, man. Why don't you tell people a little bit about yourself and the little project you got going there?
Yeah, myself, well, you reach me, and I'm in Los Angeles right now, so it's middle of the day, 4 o'clock, sunny Los Angeles, originally from the greater Boston area myself, Vinny, and I hooked up with Paul Wittenberger, who co-produced and directed and edited What in the World Are They Spraying? a good friend of mine. I met him right when I first moved to Los Angeles, and we've been friends ever since. And, you know, once he edited that film, I worked with him a little bit, just, you know, giving him pointers, you know, with the edits. And I wasn't really, you know, comfortable with coming forward. He kind of wanted me to be a little bit more, play a better, more intricate role within that What in the World Are They Spraying? And at the time, I just, you know, wasn't ready to poke my head out there. So at the end of that film, we both realized that here we are with these heavy metal toxins again, metals, metallics. It kept resonating in all the research that I was doing on the side. And at the time, I was looking into fluoride. And I looked at Paul and I said, here we go again, Paul. What is with these metals? These metals, I'm telling you, there's something going on with the metals and the neurological disorders that we're seeing today. So he and I both looked at each other and said, let's do a film. Let's make a film based on the food. We'll look at all three components, our food, our air, and our water. And 17, 18 months later, that one film turned into a trilogy just because we've gathered 70 terabytes of interviews and footage, and trying to jam that all into 95 minutes is it's just too much for the audience. And in addition to the three issues, you know, food, air, water, we also have solutions. So it only left about 15 to 20 minutes per topic, and it just wasn't enough. So we decided to break it up into a trilogy, and we just got finished with the final edit on the fluoride film. So we're really excited.
So it's like the truth of Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Right, totally.
Yeah, it was... And by chance, the second one also called The Two Towers?
The Two Towers, huh? We got it. That's a whole film in itself right there.
Yeah, man. Absolutely. And all truth is out there. Get into the information. Get into it Helm's Deep style, all right? Mm-hmm. But the other thing I wanted to talk about specifically is actually just about you, Chris, yourself, and what your upbringing was and stuff like that, you know, what your parents did and stuff like that. Because a lot of activists, when they get into it, it's usually because of one or two reasons in my experience. Is either A1, they were really, really awesome at doing, pretty much anything they put their mind to, and they got shafted real badly by some establishment scumbag and made them hate the establishment and then fight back against it for the rest of their life to make sure it doesn't screw over anybody else. Or two, they were kind of born into an environment where it was commonplace to see it all around them, and it was kind of inevitable.
Yeah, I guess, my background, my upbringing, my dad was a firefighter in the city of Worcester, which is just outside of Boston. It's the second largest city in New England. So I kind of had that heroic kind of upbringing with a dad who was constantly saving lives and being in the newspaper and taking off his mask and saving babies and jumping out of windows. And he was just a gung-ho guy. And, I never wanted to follow in his footsteps in terms of being a firefighter myself. But, as a kid, I liked playing on the trucks. but I guess, you know, what really kind of, I'm trying to think back because it's a really good question. And when did I really start seeking truth? And that's really all this was for me personally. I just remember being so young and thinking to myself, what is with these presidents that make all these promises to us during their presidential campaigns? Then when they become elected, nobody follows through on what they promised us. And it, just as, you know, I mean, I'd had to say maybe 10 or 11 years old, you know, thinking this, and I can remember it. And I came to the conclusion at that age that they must be working for somebody else. They're, you know, they must be answering to someone else. And my whole life, I just was constantly searching for truth and answers. While everyone was, you know, off watching cartoons or, you know, watching sports on television, I was, you know, watching the History Channel and reading books and trying to just do my own quest, really. And it's just been evolving. And as once the internet came on board, and trust me, I'm 40 years old, so I was around prior to the internet. And at work, when I was in the financial sector, Vinny, for quite some time, And I would constantly, I would use my downtime in between phone calls and whatnot is just, you know, looking for truth, trying to find out what's going on in the world today. And, you know, never satisfied with mainstream media. You know, once I started following the money in every industry and it started leading to the same path, down the same path to the same groups of people, it was pretty evident early on, you know, for me anyway, that there's something more to all this global agenda.
See, the other side of it is, you wonder, have you wasted any part of your life? Because whenever your bad things happen to you, or whenever you like go in a job for a long time or something like that, you come out and you've got nothing to show for it but the memories and the experience that you had, you know, and you're thinking, man, was that a waste of time? It's not really. I think whatever happens to you throughout your life, it's kind of like Legos, you know? Each and every little bit of experience you have, it's just one more little bit of Lego block that you've got to work with. And some of them are pretty really messed up Lego blocks, and you don't know where the hell they fit. But the other part of it is going through life and recognizing, as we do, that it's not all wine and roses out there, that there are some real nasty people with a lot of power and stuff like that, and they don't really care whether or not we survive. It's actually quite a harsh thing to deal with unless you're doing something about it, and then it becomes a lot easier.
Yeah, I can't agree with you more, because as I journey down my path and the knowledge was coming and you know, the more I wanted to share it with people, the more frightening I could see, you know, people becoming. And to me, it was just the absolute opposite effect. It didn't frighten me. It more or less almost enlightened me, I guess you could say. You know, I just wanted to know more and have these answers. And you know, as I tried to share the knowledge, you know, I could see, you know, the dull eye look, like in headlights of people, the glazed look that comes over them when you start talking about these, you know, these different issues and situations globally that are going on. And they just do not want to know. They like the blinders that are screwed on tight to their head, and they just want to be focused on that little carrot at the end of the tunnel that they see and nothing more. And it's just a matter of, you know, encouraging people to have the courage to remove the blinders first and foremost. And that's, you know, what it takes is, once you do pull the blinders down and you do start doing the research and looking into this this knowledge, this information out there, again, you're not going to get it through the mainstream media, so you're going to have to kind of be your own reporter and investigator and do some digging on your own. And to me, that's half the battle. That's the journey. I enjoy that investigative side to it, you know. And I think as everybody I pointed in that direction, they pretty much all come back, you know, believers on their own. And I always say, look, don't take my word for it. Do the work yourself. I mean, it's got to be more interesting than the fantasy football league you're all wrapped up into. I mean, this talk about fantasy. I mean, this is reality. This is better than anything else you got going on that television screen, on that news broadcast. Look this stuff up, because it's true. And once you do, once you begin to, you know, dive down the little rabbit holes, so to speak, you know, trust me, you won't be fearful, because now once you're armed with the knowledge, then you're going to be able to make the necessary choices, the correct choices in your life and in your family's life to, you know, whether it be with this, you know, metallic situation that we're looking into on our food, air, and water, you'll be able to lessen your exposure just by obtaining this knowledge. You know, you'll be able to protect yourself, protect your family, because that's really where everything's going to start, at home, in the home. And then, you know, it's going to trickle out to friends and family. So, yeah, you hit the nail on the head with that. It's that was always a tough one, trying to convince people that it's, you know, to set aside the fear and you know, put a different spin on it, or a different light, and look at it as enlightenment, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, I find it's trauma. Trauma is a great teacher, and that's why I am of the belief that high school is a form of trauma-based mind control.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The entire educational system in this country, I mean, look who's established the NEA. I mean, if you just follow, like, who set up all these different regulatory agencies, even our educational system, the American Medical Association, I mean, it just all goes back to the same. Once you start realizing that the same group set it all up, it's going to start clicking and go, oh, no wonder why.
It's kind of like one of those magic eye puzzles. You know, have you ever seen those books full of those things? And it doesn't look like there's anything there, but if you view it from a certain direction or a certain way, you see a pyramid or you see a globe or a plane or something like that amidst all this weird shaped colors and fluff, right?
Yeah.
It's sort of like that. You're showing somebody something and they don't even know what the heck it is, and you're trying to tell them that there's something there, but they have to look at it from a certain way in order to figure out and actually see it. But a lot of people are just like me, for example, I couldn't be bothered with those magic eye books. I couldn't see anything. I just put them down and walked off.
Yeah. It's true.
So how's the point? I was talking to my mate yesterday, and you're saying, how do you convince all those people who are like middle class and are well-to-do, etc., about all of this stuff and get them to be active and blah, blah, blah? And I said, well, first of all, you don't need to, because if you want a revolution, which I think is basically what we kind of a lot of people are calling for or whatever, or a revolutionary way of living, or rather, more to the point, a revolutionary way of actually surviving and thriving, because that's anything but what we're doing at the moment. Mm-hmm. If we wanted all of that, you only need a small percentage of the population, so 2, 3, 4% maybe. Right. The rest of the people, the sheeple, as the elite call them, are almost always throughout history proven to be irrelevant to what direction society goes. They will follow whatever shepherd is put in front of them, whether that be a shepherd that will lead them to greener pastures or one that will lead them to a slaughterhouse. Mm-hmm. So in essence, I feel that the endowment with this information, as all of that, you and I and all the listeners, of course, as well, have basically been burdened with, it becomes a responsibility to save as many lives as you can. But I think we confuse the fact between we're trying to save the people who basically, they're the horse that won't drink and will force itself to die of thirst.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It is. It's almost... You mentioned, you know, looking back on your life and seeing if what your legacy is going to be or what you've left behind, and I can't think of anything better than to at least try to reach out and help a few people, and maybe that's, you know, comes from, you know, my background, you know, being a son of a firefighter. You know, I'm not sure where it's coming from, but it's just, I'll tell you this, it's a good feeling.
Well, parents have such a remarkable effect, and this is also why I encourage truthers to have unprotected sex and breed, because, my God, I mean, it's getting to be nigh on idiocracy out there, where all the stupid people are breeding out of control like rabbits and cockroaches and what have you. And sooner or later, the average walk down the street won't be entirely different from the average George A. Romero zombie movie.
Yeah, totally.
The education system's getting worse, more vaccinations, more frickin' American Idol. How brain numbing. It's almost as like, it's like brainwashing is addictive, mm-hmm. don't you think?
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And you get a real fat head full of it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's hypnotic to these people. They can't shut their TVs off. I've done away with my cable but the freaking signal keeps coming through my house. They won't shut it off. I've shut it off myself. I just canceled it altogether like months ago, 8 months ago. And a few months back, I checked something on my TV, and boom, lo and behold, my cable signal's still coming through the TV. So I don't watch it like I used to, but it's still... I'm not paying for it. I just said that on national... radio, so
yeah, you'll probably have some kind of Swiss SWAT team. What do you call a SWAT team for that's from Switzerland? I think you call them a SWAT team.
Oh,
yeah, and they bust in each door of your house simultaneously because they've got synchronized watches. My very special guest is Chris Maple from thegreatculling.org, and we'll be right back after the break. More genocide and scumbaggery and what have you. Ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, it's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. Broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated and allegedly Fukushima irradiated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's friggin' beautiful down here. Love being a slave. My very special guest, Chris Maple from thegreatculling.org, and I imagine everybody should go and check out the website. What can people actually find at the website, mate?
Well, what we've done with the website is we've got all the links of all the various radio shows we've done, all the trailers that Paul, my co-producer, who does an amazing job with editing and filmmaking, and he's just so talented weaving all this stuff together. The poor kid just works and works and works around the clock in front of that editing bay of his. But we've got about a good. I'd say 10 trailers out there that we've done on this thing. We've been, making little updates as we've gone, down this 18-month journey. We didn't really expect it to go this long, like I said, but funding was an issue. We've been doing this pretty much out of our own pockets. And
Do you need some donations, bro?
Yeah, we do. We got a donations button right on the front page. There's a Help Us tab. People can go there and help us out. We have had some funding, some people that have supported us. We adore them. We have a following. You can sign up on our mailing list so that you can get updates from both Paul and myself. You'll be the first to get the trailers. We also have the three segments broken down: the food, the air, the water, all the interviews. There's stills in there. And you can learn about the people we have interviewed. I'm trying to think back 18 months when we first started, and I know that you had me on quite a while back, and I wanted to thank you for that, because you were the first guy to give me a shot, and it was my first radio interview, and I'm still nervous, but I want to thank you for that, Vinny.
Well, and also we talked over the break about essentially in the truth movement, and indeed when you're on radio making films and things of that nature, people identify you with the information you put out and not you as a person, so to speak. And I try to kind of break through that a little bit and get to know the filmmakers and the radio show hosts and the authors as people, kind of thing, and just how that sort of affects their perspective. And how they kind of live and work in the world. And just recently you've been blessed with a new child.
Yes, my first, that's right. I get the goosebumps when I hear that. I am now a dad. It's amazing, amazing experience. Yeah, my little daughter, London Lee Maple, she was born May 31st. And London, no pun intended with the Olympics or anything like that. It was just a name my wife had picked out when she was a little girl herself. She always adored the name, and
Hold on a second, hold on a second. So you had a daughter named London that was born in 2012.
Yeah. Right. The year of the dragon, right? Mind you. What that serpent means, that dragon, that serpent. But it's just amazing, man. It was just we did the home birth with the midwives, no vaccinations. This baby's bubbly, all breast milk. She's just so intelligent already and strong. It's just such an amazing thing. Do you have children of your own, Vin?
No, me and Sarah, we're going to be trying for our first soon enough. I think in October we're going to go to the fertility doctor and get checked and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, I'm hoping to have a little miniature scumbaggery exposer. I'll get him like a little baby megaphone or something like that. It'll be great.
Well, my wife and I, what we do, you know, this filmmaking thing is all new to me. Like I said, you know, Paul's a friend of mine, and, you know, he's always been an activist and started – you know, helping me with my movement, my journey, and he's just such a great guy. I'm just trying to remember what the heck it was I was going to say.
Well, there was also the other question I wanted to ask is just like the perspective that you have on life as a conspiracy theorist and getting the truth out about the fact that we're all kind of on the verge of extermination. Add on to that, you now actually have another human life that's utterly dependent on you, your first daughter and something like that. I'd imagine the perspective kind of changes a little bit.
It really does. It's more of an urgency. There's no doubt about it. I mean, I am... just like look at that into her little eyes, and I wonder what the future is going to be, and I think I'm more compelled now to make this world a better place. There's no doubt about it. I mean, what got me going originally was the whole vaccination schedule, and this was, you know, over a year, almost 2 years ago, when I learned about the vaccine increase and also the spike in autism, and with autism in the United States, it's going through the roof. I mean, it's every year the rates are going up and up and up, and now it's, I don't know, one in every 90-something children in the U.S. alone, and in the state of California, it's one in every 40-something. It was 50-something a couple years ago. It's extremely alarming to me. It was the attack, I guess you could call it, on the children that got me going, and now that I have one of my own, boy, I'm like a bear.
Well, see, now this gives rise to a very interesting theory. Is it something that happens that when somebody's an activist or something of that nature, or a conspiracy theorist, when they have a child, the amount of work or the quality of their work actually increases, not decreases because they've got all this extra responsibility of a child, but it actually gets hypercharged and a shot in the arm, ironically, so to speak. And in fact, have you noticed that that's a saying these days, giving something a shot in the arm is to hype it up and soup it up or make it better or something like that? Whereas for my money, you know, shot in the arm is like, hey, do you want autism?
Yeah. Line up with this new, what the CDC made a release of, the new pig swine flu coming out, right? The new pig flu with advertising here now. So,
you know, yeah. And you'd think that's, oh my God, that's so funny. So literally the government is warning us that pigs have flu.
Yeah, all right, pig flu. When pigs fly, well, they're fluing. Oh, man, you got to laugh. You got to have a sense of humor about it. You really do.
Well, what else choice do you have? I presume you meet a lot of people like I do who know this kind of information, but they don't deal with it quite as well, and they've gotten kind of aggressive and exert a lot of sort of antisocial behavioral aspects. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, I do. It's a lot of paranoia. There's no doubt. You know, everyone's wondering, all right, is he, what side is he on, or what angle you're coming from? You know, and I'm just like, look. I'm just about truth, man. I just wanna share what I know, and hopefully you can share what you know with me, and we can, you know, chew the meat and spit the bones and move on and you know, share it with someone else.
Well, I like to have kind of positive reactions with to people and stuff like that. That's why when I'm interviewing them, I don't contradict them or argue with them or stuff like that. I just let them say their piece and whatever. And it's not because I don't value the truth or anything like that. It's just I value friendship. And you focus on the points that you agree together, and you'll be surprised at just how much more you accomplish than if the only thing that you talk to somebody about is when they say the one thing out of a million things they said that you disagree with.
Yeah.
And it's the only time that you actually go to interact with them. It's like, hey, man, I've been listening to you for 4 years, never sent you a message, but you had this one guy on who said one thing this one time, like in an archive show, like about a year ago, that I fully disagree with, and now I'm never going to listen to you again.
Chew the meat, and spit out the bones, right? There's a lot of bones, there's no doubt.
And it's about how much time you're actually willing to spend, right? Whether people are worth your time. Do you ever get like this? I mean, is there much outreach in the streets for you involved with this, or is it mostly just going towards people who are already on board and trying to get information for your film and things?
Whether I'm working on the film or not, I'm always trying to educate people, whether it be at my, you know, work. You know, my wife and I have a photography business. It's what we do when we're not filmmaking, when I'm not. It's what we, you know, pay the bills with. Is my wife and I shoot weddings and babies, so I'm constantly trying to educate new parents on, you know, the dangers of vaccinations. And I'll tell you, it's definitely a room splitter. You know, you bring up vaccinations and it divides the room. There's no doubt. But I'm not afraid to, you know, to speak my mind. And at least, heck, if I can get somebody fussy enough, they'll take some time to look it up themselves instead of regurgitating what CNN or MSN says about it or the CDC. And heck, you know, that's half the battle right there, because... And like I said earlier, Vin, I do have, you know, I do have some people that are coming back to me and thanking me, and people I would never even thought were listening to me, you know, that even, so that's really rewarding in a sense. And it's not about the reward again, it's about the awareness and change, and that's what I'm all about.
Well, it's about getting it out there, and whenever you start getting the info out there, it always has an effect, and it always comes back to you.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Cause and effect.
In some way, shape, or form. And a lot of people I've found in the truth community spend the majority of their time listening to other people's radio shows, reading other people's articles, maybe sharing them on Facebook and things of that nature. But that's where their interaction stops. There's no, there's very little face-to-face. There's very little voice communication. It's mostly just typing and things of that nature. And it takes away a lot of the social element behind human interaction. And I remember I was calling up Radio Live one time here in Auckland, and a guy named Mikey Havoc, who's a local DJ, and he's a big 9/11 truther, and we called up and started talking about 9/11 and stuff like that, and he says, yeah, but sometimes, you know, when you talk about all this conspiracy stuff, like one of my friends, he kind of went a little bit nuts and blah, 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 and I say, well, that didn't happen to you, did you, Mike? And he goes, no. And I say, well, are you a very social person? Are you always going around meeting new people and things like that? You're a DJ, of course you do. And I said, that's the difference between you and your friend. Your friend didn't have other people to talk to bounce off, and other different experiences that would allow him to not be so tunnel visioned and to make him drive himself nuts because of all this conspiracy junk, okay? Mm-hmm. You need humans around you all the time, and this is what I say to people. Whenever you're feeling down, whenever you're feeling alone, whenever you're feeling like it's too much, keep reaching out, and keep reaching out until you grab a hold of something. But don't hold on to the people that are basically the hand that's holding you down, you know? There's 7 billion people on the planet. Why would you bother spending any of your time with people that don't educate you, inspire you, or at the end of the day, really give a flying frack about you, you know? Value the good people, you know? And those people often return value to you. But I presume, and since you started doing this, a lot of really cool relationships have started to emerge, haven't they?
Yeah, they really have. And I've actually, like you've mentioned, I've dropped quite a few too. I've dropped the anchors, so to speak, in my life. And you know, I'm just looking for inspiration, and you know, if you're not down with, you know, knowledge and truth, and you want to stay in your bubble, you know, that's great. You know, that's great for you. It's not great for me. But so I have kind of moved beyond, you know, beyond some close relationships in my life here, and it's okay, you know, because I have gained some really wonderful friendships along the way, and you know, people that are, you know, in their 70s and 80s are good friends of mine, you know that this whole fluoride issue with Dr. David Kennedy is one of my biggest allies down in San Diego, and he's just great. He's awesome, Kennedy. He's going to be a big part of this film, The Great Culling Our Water, which is part one, which is going to be done by the end of this month. We'll be packaging it by the end of the month. So just, you know, relationships like that, these various doctors and physicians that I've been dealing with, and, you know, I've got, I feel like I could pick the phone up and, you know, in any part of the world right now and make a phone call if I needed a couch, you know, and that's a good feeling. I didn't have that prior to this journey. So there really is a definite reward thing that goes on. And I can't echo your sentiments more with the power of communication. And, you know, just like you and what you do with this radio show and what we're doing right now, having this conversation, it's just what it's about, you know, and it is about doing the face-to-face thing. And like I said, not a lot of people are, you know, a lot of people are hermits that just aren't really good at it, or just kind of sit in front of their computer and hit blogs or, you know, whatever.
It's like experience, you know, like you can learn to argue on blogs or you can learn to argue in person. But the thing is, if you're arguing on blogs, you get to decide what you're arguing about, where you say, or whether or not you do that comment. You've got a lot of control and you've got a lot of privacy. Whereas if you're right there in front of somebody and you've got to like be back and forth, and you've got to figure out what makes somebody really, really angry so you can avoid those topics, and you can figure out what they're interested in so you can lean more towards those. It's a real complicated process, and it takes a lot of experience. And I learned the bulk of my communication skills, you know, doing telesales. I had a 50% strike rate. So out of half the people that would pick up that phone, having never heard of me before, having never heard of my company before, I would be able to communicate with them clearly and decently and be able to sell them some decent phone packages that would save them money, sort of thing. That was how good I got. And now I think I'm using it, my skills during that job, that, well, at the end of the day, screwed me over, to actually give some real value to people for a change. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com.
Me driving and I won't stop. And it feels so good to be alive and on top. My reach
on top.
My tower secure.
All right.
Is noble. My power is,
ladies and gentlemen, it's the final segment of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, New Zealand's number one truther talk radio show. 5 days a week. The other Truth to Talk radio show hosts that I know that are based in New Zealand are at most 1 day a week. One of them does 1 hour, one of them does 3 hours. So, and they don't archive their shows or put them out too much. So if you support New Zealand having an alternative media, you cannot point a stick at anybody in this country except me, right? In terms of real alternative media that's full-time, getting it in there, making sure there's always stuff on YouTube, always audio archives, always big guests and stuff like that, real information. Nothing else like this exists in this country. It's just me. I have many, many friends all over the truth movement in New Zealand, and I have put them onto YouTube. I have put them onto the radio so that they can instead be now part of the media reporting arm of this country, because any other country that it's happening in, doesn't matter whether it's happening in the United States, the United Kingdom, or anything like that, they're all connected. Very similar methodologies are being put in place. And so it doesn't matter whether somebody's telling you about tyranny here or tyranny over there, it'll always be in your back door, whether or not you like it. So if you want to support me in the work that I'm doing, what most people are doing is either donating at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. You can press the big donate button, or you can put a payment in through the company, the the bank account there for Guerrilla Media. It's a New Zealand bank account. A lot of people are putting in automatic payments into there, like $5, $10, $20. I've even got one subscriber giving $35 a month, just so that we can keep all the bills paid and keep doing everything here. Now, that's me, because I have a constant project and I need constant, consistent funding. And the only way that you can ever get money for telling the truth is basically, in my opinion, from the people who wish to see the truth continue to be put out. Chris, on the other hand, has a very specific project, this The Great Culling, and the films and things of that nature that have very specific costs. And big film production and things of that nature, I'm doing it on the fly here, real cheap and what have you. That's why I don't need a ridiculous amount of money or whatever. But when you're doing big film projects, it can be quite costly. And Chris, I'd like you to fill in for the listeners, and I think we might turn this into a short little YouTube clip as well, just how desperate the situation is for you, and just how much do you really need in order to finish these films, or even just finish the first one?
Yeah, sure. I mean, now that it's you know, now that we've broken it up into three parts, it's nice because we've done the bulk of the work on all three films as far as interviews and whatnot. You know, what do we need right now? Part one, our water, the fluoride film, is in post sound. Just this post sound takes 3 weeks to a month. And that is a bill of $9,500. We've already paid much of that. We still owe $6,500 to her. She did the post on What in the World 2, very professional. So they put music to it. They tweak all the audio levels. It takes quite a bit of time. And believe me, I was just blown away myself, because these, you know, filmmaking is something that's new to me. It's a new hat. As is producing, as is these radio shows, as is asking for money. I cringe, but we need it, and I can't do it alone, especially with this new baby. I've got everything of my own invested into it, as does Paul. And we're basically the sole investors on it, which is what's took us so long. You see, Paul, with What in the World Are They Spraying, that film that I'm sure the majority of your audience has seen, it's had over 200 million views on the internet. They raised $100,000 in 24 hours through at G. Edward Griffin's website. They took that money to make the film, and they still went over budget. We don't have that $100,000, and we're doing three films. We're close to finishing. It's probably another reason what's taken us a little longer to do it, but we're getting there, and we'll do it, but we do need help. We want to get it out quick. This $6,500 bill will kind of make us even. You know, we still need more money to buy drives to back up the film. We still haven't even backed up everything, and that's kind of makes me nervous. But, you know, 70 terabytes is expensive just to back it up and put it in the attic, never mind buy another set of drives just to work off of. You know, just the drives alone are like 15 grand. So, costly stuff.
Also, at this point, once you've gotten things done, you've still got all that equipment, so that making your next film will be a lot cheaper, and also you'll have the experience to make the next film even better.
Yeah, it's so true. Part two, we're already we're already in the editing. We're editing our part two is going to be our food and vaccinations. They're going to be kind of together, and we're still lining up. Now that it's going to be a full length feature on its own, so we still have a little bit more, you know, time to gather some more interviews that we would want to have got. So yeah, we're definitely getting better at it. I can see us doing this in the future. From there's so many movies to be made. We already have on our docket with these three films, plus we have two additional films that we're starting to shoot as well. So we're going to be making films forever now. It's just getting over the hump on part one. And I'm sure once we do, we'll have the capital from part one to reinvest in the part two and really pump it out quick. And then part three will come flying right after that.
I presume once you've recouped your capital off DVD sales and things of that nature, you might be able to upload it to YouTube platforms, things like that?
Oh, we're definitely going to do that right out of the gate too. We're not going to withhold it from YouTube. We're gonna have a. I know Mike Adams is talking about releasing just a click counter on his website too. I think a dollar for anybody just who wants to watch it. We're also going to do a release on YouTube too, so let people copy it, spread the word. It's about spreading the word, and whatever we can recoup on sales, we can get a couple sales in there to help, pay to make this thing, then we'll be happy. And if you can help us, make these, in the future, I need to be doing this full time and put my photography camera down, and there's just too many films to be made.
Yeah, it really is, and I find it's like if you broadcast that there are lots of films to be made, if you broadcast the fact that you need donations, if you don't ask, you don't get, right?
Absolutely.
So I think now's the time where people in the truth movement need to realize that this is an industry, and just like any industry, it costs money. And despite the fact that we are working for a better future for truth, liberty, freedom, and justice, it doesn't mean that the current evil system of oligarchical financial control over virtually everything that we do doesn't exist. Okay, we still have to live in this society. We still have to work in it, and we still have to make our films and get our productions out regardless. And as I said before, it is up to you, the listeners, you, the viewers who view this at my YouTube channel, Mr. News Guerrilla Media, who go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com, and also, of course, the people who are supporting Chris by going to thegreatculling.org. And also, one of the things that really helped me, Chris, when I was getting kicked out of my house, right, and I had no money. I'd just given the last of what was on my credit card to the missus so she could get her teeth fixed at the dentist and all of this kind of stuff, and absolutely desperate, absolutely at my wit's end. And my good friend Simon Kaiwai says, "Hey, mate, have you heard about this chip-in widget?" And you go to chipin.com, and you set a specific amount, and you have about a month or so running on it, and it has a raising of the thing, kind of like the, how schools raise money, and they've got the little thing, little bar that kind of raises up to the top that they need. And I think it was within 72 hours, I had enough money to pay for my first 2 weeks' rent, my bond, and for the moving truck, because basically that chip-in widget was so effective at people getting it into, and also the fact that I really, really needed it. And it seems like at this point, at the cusp of your new film being released, you desperately, desperately need this $6,500.
Yeah, I mean, that's just for the sound. We also we need DVD art. We need someone to help us design the cover. I mean, Jabba Griffin used his artist to help with What in the World, and we're just trying to. I mean, we've got a lot of donated music on this film. We've got everyone donated their time for the interviews. There's, we had brought some interns in that donated a little bit of time. Then we started paying them immediately out of our pockets to help with the edit on the end. And I mean, I need artwork. If there's any artists out there that want to, donate and some of their time and their talents, and as far as getting their image out there, it's this film will be global. We definitely have markets, from one end of this globe to the next right now, Australia, and we have some friends in New Zealand, and we know it's going to be sold. So it'd be a great platform for even an up and coming artist who wants to get their name out there with maybe helping us design our cover.
Mm-hmm. And I may be able to help you with that as well. A good friend of mine, Roy, who does the artwork for the VinnieEastwoodShow.com humor page and all of that, like that. He's a spectacular artist. He's right up there, in my opinion, with skill levels comparable to David Dees and what have you. So I actually really do want to hook you two up, because if you have a real bitching-looking DVD cover, I think it might sell a lot better for you, mate.
Yeah, it's huge. It's true. You're absolutely right. I mean, that's what's going to... Unfortunately, too many people judge books by covers, especially movies, when they grab that DVD.
Okay. Well, I'll see what we can do for you. And also, Chris, if you have any spare time now, we're going to be starting the Vinnie Eastwood Show social network Skype call. So if you wish to join in the Skype call, Chris, I'd be much obliged, but I'd understand if you have to leave as well, because you're probably very busy.
Yeah, I'd love to hang around, but I do unfortunately got to run. The wife's got the baby in the back room, and it's my hour to bounce her around. So I wish
all
I
right.
could. Her. But thank you for having me, Vinny, so much, and thanks to all your audience and everybody out there. So God bless.
All right. Chris Maple, ladies and gentlemen, thegreatkelling.com. And if you'd like to join in the Skype chat with other people from around the world, the listeners to this show, and, of course, myself, please join us in the chat room at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, and we'll get your Skype details off you and get the call started in about 5 minutes' time. Thanks very much, and we'll see you again, ladies and gentlemen.